I'm Jim Pinkerton. Welcome to bloggingheads.tv, a special edition in which the topic is Sarah Palin. And with us to tell us about Sarah Palin and who she is and where she's from is Dave Noon, who is a professor of history at the University of
Alaska.
The
University of Alaska Southeast, the Juneau.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, let's start right there.
Yeah.
I mean, we know so little about Alaska. So, Dave, this is really, truly, this is, you know, while Palin is still hot and fresh, and I got to watch my puns and double entendres there, tell us about where the state, where she is from.
Well, you know, I've been here about 6 years, and it's definitely the most unusual place that I've ever lived. You know, when you're here for the first time, you have this experience where, you know, every sentence you could possibly utter becomes suddenly more sort of gravitational by adding in Alaska at the end of it. So, you know, I'm driving down the road. You know, anywhere else it's pretty boring, but I'm driving down the road in Alaska. You know, my dog is taking a dump in the front yard in Alaska. And suddenly, you know, it becomes like this absolutely, you know, sort of, you know, overwhelming thing. But, you know, I think that you know, in all seriousness, I mean, there's something about Alaska that has been, I think, aggressively mythologized throughout American culture. And some of this, you know, goes back to the old 19th century, you know, Frederick Jackson Turner kind of myth of the frontier, the idea that Alaska is this place that's, you know, disconnected from the ordinary processes of modernity, that it's a place, you know, sort of a zone where a different kind of liberty is possible. And I think that in a lot of ways that there's, you know, such, it's an exaggeration. In some ways it's just fundamentally untrue. But as far as the mythology of Alaska is concerned, you know, I think Alaskans imbibe a lot of this. It really comes down to two things. The notion that Alaska is this pristine wilderness, this kind of old conservationist environmental ethos that goes back to the 19th century with John Muir and George Brownell. And then the second one, which is...
Who is that? John Muir? Who's the second one?
George Bird Grinnell. He was an anthropologist and a naturalist. He came up here, you know, right around 1899 to do this sort of massive series of explorations and tours. Actually, it's really the first tour ship that comes up here, or among the first. And it really, his voyages and his publications did a lot to promote this idea of Alaska as this last frontier. You know, but then on the other hand, you've got this sort of counteracting mythology of Alaska as a resource basin. And that's the drill, baby, drill kind of approach. And it gets to a fundamental problem that anyone who's ever possessed Alaska, non-natives at least, have confronted, which is how to make this very remote landscape profitable. And no one who's ever possessed Alaska has done a particularly good job of striking a balance between, you know, sort of sustaining the environment of the place, you know, while also trying to convert it to bring it into the orbit of civilization.
Okay, let's go back on this. I mean, Frederick Jackson Turner was an historian, I think at Harvard, who wrote a essay in 1894 or something like that.
Yeah, I think 93.
93, about the sort of the closing of the American frontier and how now that the Census Bureau has officially declared the frontier closed, I don't know exactly how they arrived at that, but it's a reasonable argument to make, that sort of American history had now changed. We've gone from being a place where you can simply go over the next hill to seek your fortune to a place where you'd have to sort of learn how to live with each other better and so on and so on. And it's an incredibly influential thesis. And I guess the question is in Alaska, is it not true? I mean, you hear things like down here, and I'm probably one of 90% of Americans who've never set foot in the state of Alaska, that the federal government owns 96% of the land or something like that. Is that one of those factoids?
Boy, I'm trying to remember the data. You know, it's I guess about 400 million acres of land. The state, I think, owns about 103. Alaska Natives have about 44. So I don't think it's 96%. I should have this data kind of, you know, at my fingertips, but I don't. But yeah, like a lot of you know, trans-Mississippi western states, particularly the Rocky Mountain states, you know, Alaskans don't control a substantial sort of percentage of the state's territory. So that, and I think that, you know, that gets to this other, you know what Turner was talking about was this idea of the frontier as a place where you could escape, you know, you could sort of, you know, run away from civilization, you could get, you know, land, you could have the opportunity to start over. And Turner acknowledged that the 1890 census marked the closing of the frontier. And what he, you know, kind of hinted at was that Americans were going to kind of recreate the frontier in sort of imaginative ways, you know, so with like Western fiction and, you know, the whole sort of culture of the frontier becomes a way to sort of compensate for the loss of the actual frontier. I think that was something that he was.
We started making movie westerns.
Yeah, and the dime novels, of course, the precursors to that. But yeah, I think that you know, in a lot of ways, that this kind of Western mythology is very much a part of how Alaskans even experience the state themselves. You know, we live here, and yet we're also kind of captive to the mythology of independence. But the reality, of course, is that we're heavily dependent, and that's, as I said, been the reality for you know, everyone who's ever claimed Alaska from outside. I mean, it was the Russian problem, and that's why they dumped it in our lands. And it's been an American problem since 1867.
Is problem the right word? You think of the Russians as like they just needed the money, and so they figured they could cash in quicker by selling it to us than by going to exploit it themselves.
Right.
So that's more of an asset figuring out how to be utilized. Is that fair?
Yeah. I think that's. I guess maybe, you know, conundrum has been a better way to do it. You know, and the Russians tried to create a diversified economy, and they could never do it. And the United States has tried over, you know, nearly a century and a half now to sort of turn Alaska into a diversified economy. But the fundamental reality of it is that our economy depends on resource extraction and very particularly, you know, mineral extraction. And, you know, the rest of it comes from federal aid. Without, you know, without our dependence on the national government, you know, Alaska wouldn't be, you know, sustainable in the way you couldn't have, you know, even 650,000 people like we have here. It's a very difficult
right.
place.
It is interesting. A lot of these Western states, you know, Montana, Idaho, for example, and I realize Sarah Palin, who is our subject here, went to school in Idaho as well as Alaska.
Right.
Were heavily unionized, or not, at least reasonably heavily unionized, and therefore kind of democratic.
Yeah,
until sort of the Eisenhower era, I guess.
Yeah, you know, the political reality of Alaska is also very, very strange. You know, it's you know, heavily Republican now, and it has been for you know, quite some time. I think right around the Nixon era, I think Johnson was the last Democratic presidential candidate to win the state. But at the same time, the political parties aren't particularly strong here. Alaskan politics has always been driven primarily by personalities and characters. And so it makes for these very strange kind of political dynamics where the parties themselves aren't as significant as the individuals or the coalitions that develop around these individuals.
In one-party states, and Alaska does seem to be kind of a one-party state now in terms of the Republicans, at least until, you know, whenever. Is there an identifiable faction, Palin versus anti-Palin? Palin was, when she ran against the incumbent governor, Republican Frank Murkowski, 2 years ago, was it just her own personality, or did she represent some faction of within the Republican Party against the other faction?
Well, the party reality of it is, of course, that Palin was not the preferred candidate of the kind of the anchor weight of the Republican Party. You know, she happened to come along at a pretty opportune time because Murkowski was, frankly, just horrible, he was overwhelmed by intra-party challengers in 2006, and Palin happened to be the I hesitate to say the default candidate, but she really didn't she was able to sort of capture a kind of popular support in lieu of party support. And I think it's tough to say whether she sort of rearranged the party dynamics. She has a lot of folks within the Republican Party who really don't like her at all, and have not had particularly, you know, kind things to say about her. You know, so I guess I'm not really answering the question terribly.
No, right. So is it? I mean, again, one party states, like southern states, for example, would typically have a kind of bourbon aristocrat cavalier class of, you know, owners and plantation owners and main streets and so on, and then there'd be a rival version of it, which would be sort of in Georgia they call them the wool hat, wool, W-O-O-L hats. You know, the rednecks, for lack of a better word.
Right, right.
And they would fight each other continuously for power, you know, in state after state after state. And, you know, in some states like Alabama, the wool hats usually won. In other states like Virginia, the Cavaliers usually won. And other states would sort of oscillate back and forth. When these names were all big cheeses down here, because they've been chairman or ranking members of committees for, you know, Don Young, Ted Stevens, Murkowski, who was a senator for, you know, 2 decades.
Yeah.
I mean, these are all big fish in Washington. Did they represent, was there an identifiable, you know, Murkowski, Palin, Stevens wing, or is it just sort of more ad hoc?
I'd have to say it's more ad hoc. I mean, you know, Palin utilized these folks to the extent that she needed to. You know, she endorsed Frank Murkowski when he ran for governor in 2002, after she lost her bid to be the lieutenant governor, her party's nominee for that position. So she endorsed Frank Murkowski. She's endorsed Ted Stevens over the years, and so to some extent she's by necessity, I think, pragmatically, she's had to be kind of a part of that. But I think on the other hand, one thing that we see with Palin, what her administration has done, and she's, you know, surrounded herself with people that really come from Wasilla and come from the Mat-Su Valley region, which is just sort of northwest of Anchorage. And I don't know if that really represents a kind of counterweight to the standard, the conventional Republican Party in Alaska, which, as you say,
let's talk about that. I mean the Wasilla, Alaska, is again one of those places where, you know, tourists and Democratic opposition researchers and reporters are all flocking to now to interview, you know, ex-librarians and so on and so on. Is there anything in particular to be said about that town and that valley?
Well, it's the fastest growing region in Alaska, and it's you know, for good or ill, it has mimicked you know, a lot of what we see in the sort of the suburban sprawl, you know, which of course has been very important to the National Republican Party, you know, over the last couple of decades. But at the same time, you have a lot of longtime residents of that area who, you know, object to some of the changes that have taken place and some of the changes that Palin, in fact, presided over when she was mayor. The rapid kind of big box commercial development, I think is something that if you've talked to people who are from Wasilla and are longtime residents, you know, you do find a sort of disgruntled faction of people who think that Palin is you know, not necessarily, you know, representing the region terribly well, or hasn't done a whole lot of long term good for the region.
What you hear, the big box development is obviously a hot issue in rural areas all over the country. What else is there to argue about? In terms of the local politics there. If she was clearly on the side of development and growth and sprawl. You read about it as an exurb, right? Is there lots of land in between there and Anchorage?
Yeah, well, it's just on the other side of Kinnick Arm, which is this waterway that sort of cuts between the Matsu Valley and Anchorage. And yeah, it's a massive area. I mean, Anchorage is the Anchorage region is one of the most sprawling places that I've ever seen. And I, you know, spent nearly a decade in the Twin Cities, Minnesota, which is has terrible problems with the sprawl. So there's something very familiar when you're out in the Anchorage area. But yeah, I mean, as far as like local politics there, I mean, I think it's, I haven't spent a lot of time there, so I can't speak very specifically to it. But I think that one of the sort of interesting things about Palin's nomination that I just I kind of find it kind of weird. I'll get your thoughts on this. There's this kind of romance that we have for small town political experience and. These kind of quaint narratives about someone sort of rising up through city council to the mayor's office and then onward and upward. But something that the bloggers over at Rust Belt Intellectual have been writing a lot about, which is this idea that small town politics is pretty petty and pretty nasty. I don't quite understand why we kind of fixate on the small town politic as being this kind of like ideal alternative to whatever partisan nastiness we want to get away from.
As opposed to big town partisan nastiness. I mean, the thing that I keep thinking of with Wasilla, Alaska as a phenomenon is Plains, Georgia. In 1975 and 1976, as Jimmy Carter, resident of Plains, got hot, both as a nominee and then, of course, as the ultimately victorious presidential candidate. I was in college back then, and I can remember friends of mine who were just, political types, would drive, I went to school in California, to see Plains, Georgia, to hang out and so on. And of course, they were met by lots of reporters and, I suppose a few Republican opposition researchers, and of course, lots of Mr. Haney types, if you remember Green Acres, were more than happy to sell, Plains, Georgia, tchotchkes and so on, bottles of peanuts and everything else. And the overwhelming, takeaway was, here's this cute little town full of nice little people, in the good sense, in a sort of a less Googleable era, you sort of never really know that, America's, Plains in America's in Sumter County, Georgia, were hardcore Goldwater country, hardcore George Wallace country. You can have respect for those positions, but the point is they were not the kind of liberal integrationist, ethnic Switzerland that say Johnny Apple, the late Johnny Apple, the reporter for the New York Times, would present it as. I think it's fair to say that sort of the American people were kind of fooled by a friendly press that presented Plains, Georgia as this nice place. And of course, when Jimmy Carter became president, even his most fervent admirers would admit that he was a little bit on the petty side, a little bit on the dogmatic and flinty side. And I suppose if a more searching examination of his record as a state senator from Georgia and then as a one-term governor would have probably revealed more of that.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, the way you describe that, it certainly does ring familiar with what's been sort of coming out regarding Palin's time in the mayor's office in Wasilla, and some of the local, the pettiness of some of the politics and some of course the things that have been widely reported. Allegations about policies that Palin tried to pursue, or the way that she sort of dealt with personnel matters. A lot of this stuff, I think, is I don't know to what extent most people outside of Alaska actually care about that. It's one of the interesting things for me experiencing this. In a very local way. I know what matters to Alaskans, and I know that the Alaskans are talking a lot about this stuff, and I blog at a couple of places, and I know that it's part of the conversation, but I don't know to what extent the larger kind of American observers really care to get into that stuff, or whether they.
Well, I'm not sure how much they care either, but I do know they care about Palin. Yeah. I mean, so whatever forces shaped her, they are, what they're interested in is the final product.
Yeah.
So I mean, let's start with the sort of as you see it. I mean, what should Americans know about Sarah Palin?
The one thing that I keep coming back to, and I've talked with colleagues about this. This is going to sound sort of overly pessimistic about the place of Alaska in the larger national kind of scene, but I think by virtue of the political realities and the economic realities of Alaska, I think it's very difficult for someone coming from Alaskan politics to develop a broader national vision that would be of any use in governing on the executive branch. Alaskan politics is about, getting access to resources, natural resources within the state, because that's how we fund the state government. And on a national level, as everyone's sort of been made familiar with by, the excesses of Don Young and Ted Stevens, Alaska's congressional delegation has always been devoted primarily to delivering federal resources to the state. There's a very skeptical kind of outlook that Alaskan, and not all of them, but most Alaskans and Alaskan political leaders have toward this kind of outside world. There's a feeling that Alaska is a very young state that deserves federal support disproportionately to other states. And there's a, I think, a feeling that Alaska's needs have to come first. And I think that Palin, if you look at her overall record, that's firmly the tradition in which she's been embedded. As mayor, she wanted to get resources for, her region. As governor, there's been, wide accusations, by people in her own party that she's shown kind of favoritism toward the Matsu Valley, where she's from. There's no evidence that I can see that she's ever, spent a lot of time noodling about national issues. And I think that some of that's becoming strikingly obvious as she's very, very tentatively kind of presented to the national press, and as she's put in situations where she's not being offered words written by someone else.
So they take those two points. One, that the economics of Alaska are extraction oriented, which puts them in conflict with the environmentalists, and certainly ANWR, which is certainly an issue that everybody has wrestled around with over the last few decades now. And the other is a certain orientation toward, a sort of a Mississippi approach to, elect them young and keep them there forever until they get seniority so they can bring home the bacon or the pork back home. Are there any issues? I mean, that sort of... that's not quite right. What national issues do sort of people penetrate? I mean, do people talk about Iraq? Do they talk about the subprime mortgage? They can watch CNN at least to get some sense of what's happening down here.
Yeah, no, I don't mean to suggest that people in Alaska don't think about these larger things just as a matter of course, but I'm thinking very, very narrowly in terms of the governance of Alaska and the kind of pragmatic political culture that we have. I think that a lot of those larger issues don't necessarily outweigh the local concerns, and that's of course to be expected. But by virtue of the fact that we have a large military presence in the state, issues like the Iraq War have been a part of the state's conversation. When it got to the point where several of these sort of National Guard units that were made up of Inupiat and Inuit folks way up north. These are folks that primarily joined the National Guard in order to sort of add to their kind of subsistence and very, very minimal cash economy. And so then, of course, it's the risk you take when you join the National Guard, but they got shipped off to Iraq a couple years back, and that was a big deal for people.
I think the temperature, I've been to Iraq. I was there when it was 126.
Yeah.
So...
So I think that we've got this very strange relationship politically and economically with the rest of the country. And I find it somewhat implausible to think that that someone like Sarah Palin could be prepared for the kind of role that she's conceivably going to have to fulfill. I think that's a real stretch just as a political observer here in Alaska.
We'll hold that thought for one second. Just out of curiosity, how far is Juneau from Canada? How far is the Canadian border from you?
Not far. If I were willing to climb through ice fields, I think it's a couple, at a certain point, just a few miles away.
That's what I thought. So, I mean, is the Yukon territory that's next to you, right?
I think right across the border from us, where I think it's the Yukon.
Is the political culture, obviously it's a different country, but, are these sort of political issues there too? One would imagine that the economics of Yukon, in terms of extraction and so on, are pretty similar to Alaska.
Yeah, I'm embarrassed to say that I don't know much about it.
All right, fair enough. Well, okay, let's go back to Alaska. I'm just kind of curious because sometimes you can learn a lot from these sort of international comparisons. For example. Manitoba and Saskatchewan are a lot like North Dakota and so on. When did Palin first burst on the scene as far as you were concerned?
2006, when she was running. I think she had been in the sort of turnstile of conversation about possible Senate. Candidates, when Murkowski decided he wasn't going to, when he was going to, run for governor in 2002, her name was floated as someone whom Murkowski might tap as his successor. But of course Murkowski chose his daughter instead. She made a bid for lieutenant governor that year. So she had been kind of mentioned, but it, for me personally, it wasn't until the 2006. Republican primary race that I became familiar with her. So pretty recently.
Gotcha. So when you watched her give the acceptance speech in St. Paul, what were you thinking?
You mentioned by email this piece that Jim Albrecht had written for Slate, and the point that he was making was that Sarah Palin on a national stage is a very different kind of character than represents the state in a very different way than the state actually is. And what he meant by that is, her job in this in that role and at that moment was to be the base rallier and to be the culture warrior. And so when I heard those parts of the speech, there did seem to be something very 1994-ish about the tone that she was taking and the words that she was being asked to speak. It was a very different Sarah Palin than what we've typically seen as governor, much more ideological, her ideological kind of character kind of came out a little more in that speech. So I found it was certainly bizarre, to witness that.
You're saying she was more ideological on the national stage than she was back in Alaska.
Well,
because the perception is to win a Republican primary, you got to run to the right, and all the sort of news reports about her church and so on have given people down here the impression that this is what she was like up there.
Yeah, well, and I think she is. I mean, I think that her the political reality of Alaska is a very pragmatic political culture, and Sarah Palin as governor has not been as overtly ideological as I think she might be in a different political environment. I think she's a real, genuine social conservative, and we know so talking to people who have been around her in private or behind the scenes as a public figure, we know that she bears a lot of this sort of ideological weight. And but as a governor, she hasn't really been able to, because the legislature won't allow her to pursue these kinds of policies. And most Alaskans really wouldn't, feel like being detained by the kind of social conservative policies. So I think that as a person, she's extremely conservative. But as a governor, the circumstances have not enabled her to be or to govern as conservative as I think she would probably prefer.
So okay, that's interesting. I mean, pre-Palin, Alaska had sort of, and pre-Stevens, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, Alaska had sort of reputation as being sort of libertarian. The Libertarian Party was relatively strong there. I think they actually elected a state legislator there one time. Mm-hmm. I a little fuzzy on this. You guys decriminalized marijuana, at least you did for a while.
That's probably a good thing.
And so maybe now sort of the old hippies who became libertarians in their old age have sort of died off or something and been replaced by Christians with big families.
Well, I think it's actually, to some extent that's true. I mean, certainly the development of the oil and gas, the oil resources in the 70s, the construction of the pipeline brought a tremendous flow of people from Texas and Oklahoma and Louisiana, and it brought with it, I think, a very different kind of conservatism. I mean, Alaska's always had this kind of libertarian streak, but as I said earlier, it's a dependent libertarianism. Like libertarians that couldn't survive without massive, federal aid.
Sort of like Wall Street.
Well, yeah, precisely. It's a dependent individualism. And I think that's always been a part of Alaska's culture, even among, a lot of the progressives. I mean, you find there's definitely a libertarian streak among Alaskan progressives that's different than what you're going to find elsewhere in the country. So I think that Palin is a part of something that is fairly new to Alaska, as far as social conservative ideology is concerned.
And the legislature, is the legislature reflecting this change, or is it still, you made it sound like they were sort of, at least on the social stuff, to the left of her, the state legislature?
And maybe not to the left of her, but just not really driven to act on this stuff. Like, for example, abortion politics play a role in state affairs, and we've had, rounds of legislation that have been struck down by the state Supreme Court, or we had our kind of conversation about, domestic partner benefits for gay and lesbian couples, and that sort of got resolved. So social conservative, social issues do play a role in the legislature, but generally, it's dominated by, some questions about just, what to do with all the oil money that we've been raking.
Now, how much money I see there's different numbers, but how much money people have gotten, or people get a year from the state of Alaska government?
It's based on a formula, and if I were, smarter about economic matters, I could explain it to you. But basically, there's a 5-year lag. If I'm not mistaken, the refunds that the dividend payments that we just got were based on oil prices from several years ago. So there's some sort of formula that they use. The amount of the dividend payment changes from year to year. In the 6 years I've been here, it's been anywhere from like $850 to about $2,000, which is what it was this year. So
there's still a sales tax and an income tax and so on?
There's no income tax. Okay. We have, and there's no state sales tax. There are a variety of mostly regressive state taxes on alcohol, cigarettes, and gambling, but we don't have a state income tax. We couldn't even pass a 1% state income tax about 5-6 years ago.
So most of the state revenue comes from oil?
80% of it, give or take. And right now, the state is absolutely overwhelmed with money. We've got a $5 billion surplus at the moment, which is just insane.
For 700,000 people?
Even less than that, I think about 650,000.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah. I think it's one of the reasons that Palin is popular right now. I mean, she has the good fortune to be the governor of a state that's swimming in money, and I think the fact that she and the legislature got together and provided about $1 billion worth of energy relief to Alaskans is certainly something that matters.
So how did that come? I mean, does that sound sort of big governors to me? How did they pay down, or how did they help people with their energy crisis?
The short version is that we all got $1,200 stipends attached to our permanent fund dividend this year. So if you were a full-time resident of Alaska for the calendar year 2007, you just got, in addition to your $2,000 permanent fund per person, you got an additional $1,200. So someone like Palin's family, $18,000, $19,000. Trigg, the youngest one, wouldn't get it because he wasn't here for
$18,000 for what? I'm sorry.
Palin's family would have gotten.
So five people would get $18,000 or $19,000.
Yeah, so about this year it was like $3,000 per person. Yeah, so a family of five would get $15,000.
So this probably more than wipes out anybody's tax burden, right? Not anybody's, but I mean, not Vega Oil or whatever that company that was allegedly bribing Ted Stevens, but
Vico, yeah.
But the your average, if you make $50,000 a year or $75,000 a year in Alaska and there's no income tax, there's no state sales tax, it's sort of hard to imagine how. I mean, you're this is a great system if you can swing it, which is to say, the government pays you to live there.
Yeah, in effect, yeah, because of course it's taxes on oil revenues that fund the government, and that's why we had the surplus, and that's why we were able to all get this extra flow of cash. On the other hand, the offsets are pretty huge. I mean, Alaska is an extraordinarily expensive state to live in. For rural Alaskans, is primarily native. And I should say this, when people use the word native in Alaska, and down in the lower 48, and you hear people talking about natives, and it sounds very strange. But yeah, it's Alaska natives are primarily the residents of the rural areas. And there's for many of these folks, those dividend payments are the only, or it's a major source of their cash economy. It's important to clarify kind of what the what all these revenues do and don't do. I think a lot of folks in the lower 48 or the lower and western 49 have an image of Alaska as kind of, people just sort of dancing in piles of money every year, but it's not quite as lucrative as that.
but if you do, you're not going to tell anybody down here.
No, precisely. And get back. You mentioned ANWR. I mean, this is of course one of the reasons that nearly everybody in Alaska supports development in ANWR. I'm a minority, a huge minority, that I don't support it. But I'm perfectly willing to accept, people in the lower 40, if you guys want to send me and everyone up here more money, by all means, do so. You don't have to develop.
Well, the reason this comes up is because, as you know, just today's Wednesday, just last night, the Democrats caved in on offshore oil drilling.
Yeah.
For the rest of the country, and also oil shale. So in other words, I mean, it's nothing is finished yet, but one can reasonably surmise, given the enormous political shift that's occurred in the era of $4 gas prices, that there's gonna be a lot of drilling, off the east and west coasts of the United States. And I don't think any American had any idea the estimates as to how much oil and gas there is in these places that hasn't been touched.
Yeah.
And I think that one of the upshots of the surge in interest in Alaska, both with Ted Stevens just as an earmarking Hall of Famer, plus whatever else, and Don Young, and now Palin, has gotten people thinking, hey, if there is a billion or $100 billion or $1 trillion worth of oil off the coast of North Carolina, then why don't we drill it and take the money? Now, again, this is obviously not uncontroversial, but I do think that the politics of energy have shifted pretty dramatically in sort of the drill here, drill now, pay less direction.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of politicians and for that matter, citizens are thinking to themselves, you know, wow, it would be kind of nice if the government sent me a check for $2,000 or $3,000 a year.
Yeah, but I you know, the Alaskanization, if I can coin a term, of American energy policy, it's not my area of expertise, so I'm just swimming off deep water here. But it strikes me as Alaska's natural resource model is really not. I think for ecological reasons, it's not a good model for the rest of the country. But I think economically speaking, I would find it very difficult to imagine, a national sort of quest for something like the Alaska Permanent Fund. I think that the resistance to sort of taxing oil companies in a way that would fund this sort of thing is probably not. I think the resistance would be too great to that on the national scale, just because it, you know, it feeds into conservative animus toward taxation. You know, a lot of what happens in Alaska is doesn't seem particularly conservative. Palin comes in, she and the legislature raise the taxes on the oil companies. Just sort of distributing these massive surplus bonuses, redistributing corporate wealth essentially to ordinary citizens. I don't know if that's like a real viable fantasy for most Americans.
I think we're seeing some pretty heavy timber being moved around, and as the Republican Party becomes more populist and more red state, and frankly, from an economic point of view, downscale. I mean, John Kerry carried 16 of the 24 most affluent counties in the country in 2004, and I've seen several polls now that show people with incomes over $75,000 per year are voting pretty solidly for Obama, leaving people in the middle to vote for McCain. It's pretty easy for me to imagine, at least, that any Republican who's not just a hardcore, pure, Ayn Rand libertarian, would say, yeah, this is free money. Let's take it. The oil companies will do just fine. I suspect that no oil. I mean, I'm sure the oil companies scream bloody murder when Palin. I mean, I assume so. I mean, you tell me when they raise their taxes.
Yeah,
but it seems to me they're still doing it.
Yeah. Again, this is sort of out of my depth a little bit, but what I do read on the oil issue is that some of the critics of Palin, some of her conservative critics in the state, basically are arguing that the oil companies have basically stopped because of these taxes, and they may be hyperventilating on this, but they say, well, look what happens, the taxes sort of get raised, and then the oil companies kind of halt some of the movement that they might be making on the North Slope, or they raise the taxes, and now the oil and gas producers are not participating in this pipeline project that Palin's been touting all over the country. So I think that you could make an argument that it is indeed maybe something that isn't working out quite as well as Palin and a lot of her supporters claim it is. I can't say for certain, but
that of course was the original argument of the Lafferker, which is at some point the rate on tax rate comes high enough, it becomes counterproductive, and usually it's associated with income taxes, but maybe I'm sure there's an application for resource taxes too. It would be interesting to see whether capital invested in new exploration and so on is declining, and if they opened up, if ANWR is a federal land preserve, does the state still get money from it if they open it up?
Yeah, and I wish I could remember the percentages on that, but yeah, we Alaskans would benefit from that. And Alaskan support for drilling in ANWR, I think, depends on that, but also. you know, there's of course real anxiety about jobs in the state. We're such an undiversified economy. I think most Alaskans are perfectly comfortable with the idea that, you know, whatever the ecological costs or the marginal economic benefits of drilling in Anwar, and I think that those are the things that are certainly worth keeping in mind, but I think most Alaskans are perfectly comfortable thinking about Anwar as a massive public works program, you know, just waiting to happen, you know, which is, again, one of the reasons it has so much support is that there's a real fear. I mean, production on the North Slope, Prudhoe Bay, has been, you know, in a downward trend. And there's real anxiety that at some point the major source of private sort of employment is going to disappear.
Who knows? Had you ever thought of yourself as an expert on Russia? Because Alaska, and I keep reading Alaska borders Russia, and it doesn't border Russia, right? Unless I completely misapprehended the map. I mean, there's a Bering Strait.
Yeah. There's that little sort of strip of water between us. I got to say, that's just kind of one of the most comical things I've ever heard. The idea that somehow proximity, through osmosis, generates a familiarity or apprehension of what so international relations would involve. In seriousness, I mean, there is this historic relationship between Alaska and Russia, but that's really about it. You know, we have
other Russian. I mean, there's a significant Russian ethnic population.
Yeah, there's a sizable group, and we have quite a few actually at my university, students that come over, mostly from Eastern Russia.
I was actually asking about sort of ethnic holdovers from when the Russians owned Alaska.
A little bit. Not a whole lot. I mean, you see the evidence of the old Russian architecture in Sitka, which was their capital, but and the Russian Orthodox Church plays an enormous cultural role for Alaska Natives around the state.
Really?
But yeah. They were. Long after the Russians sort of discharged the territory, you still had a large Russian Orthodox presence in here. And so there's a fascinating history there, the relationship between the Russian Orthodox Church and the native populations versus the Protestant missionaries that came from the U.S. Those groups took very, very different approaches to...
How so? Considering the fact that Todd Palin is part...
The thumbnail sketch is that the Protestants in a kind of typically Protestant fashion, if you look at the larger history of Protestant Native or Protestant American Indian interactions, the Protestants came in and sought to totally transform the culture, and they established boarding schools. They aggressively tried to eradicate Native languages, substitute Protestant, particularly Presbyterian and Episcopal. Kind of practices for Native, religious traditions, whereas the Russian Orthodox Church, because of Russia's very always like minority presence, they claimed the territory, but they were always at the mercy of much of the state's Native population, and so they had the Russians in a way kind of had to assimilate themselves to Native culture if they wanted to transform. Or wanted to sort of, convert, Alaska's natives. So they did things like they learned the native languages, and they translated the Bible into native languages, and they didn't try to stamp out the native religious practice and cultural practices as much as the Protestants did. So anyway, there's a long history there, and
so a lot of these, for lack of a better word, Eskimos. I mean, I guess that's probably not politically correct to say that, but they're attendees today are members of Russian Orthodox parishes.
Yeah, particularly in Western Alaska and kind of like South Central Alaska, around in Southeast Alaska, where Juneau is, the Protestants were a lot more active, and so there's less of a Russian Orthodox influence, but definitely, you know, the farther north you get, you see the Russian Orthodox influence. And yeah, like I said, it's a really interesting aspect of the state.
So why would a Russian today, a teenager from Russia, want to go to school in Alaska?
You know, that's a good question. I think
they haven't had enough of cold. I mean, you know.
Yeah, you got me. A lot of them come over and do business degrees, and I think that you know there's their family ties. You know, there's a reasonably sized Russian population in the Anchorage area, and so I think that plays some role. But beyond that, who knows?
Hmm. Is there much bilingual? I mean, I've always mentioned ethnic language, native languages, and so on. Is there bilingualism? Is there any attempt to keep these languages going in terms of the schools and so on?
Yeah, there is. We've got at UAS, we've got a Alaska Native Studies minor, and we have a lot of folks from the Tlingit and Haida communities that come in to do sort of language recovery projects, and those are ongoing around the state. The Native corporations also do a lot of kind of cultural recovery.
What's a Native corporation? I mean, like reservations?
No, actually, we don't have reservations here. It's again one of the peculiarities about the state. When Alaska became a state, they basically had to settle Native land claims, and there were no reservations. Well, there was one very, very, you know, southern tip of southeast Juneau or southeast Alaska, but throughout the state, you know, no reservations whatsoever. And so, in order to develop the oil resources, the state had to settle the Native land claims. And so, in 1971, they did that. And basically, the mechanism for settling the land claims was that Alaska Native communities were given about 44, 45 million acres of land, and they could use that land to develop the resources to, maintain their villages. And they did that by establishing corporations. So all of the there's a patchwork of Native corporations that have been in existence for about, you know, 40 years now.
Can they have casinos?
They do. There's no casinos, but there's they do. If I'm not mistaken, there are some like pull tabs and other kinds of very light sort of gambling sort of thing. But mostly the Native corporations are, you know, they do a lot of tourism. So for example, in Juneau, the Gold Belt, which is one of the Native corporations, they own a lot of the. They do a lot of like the tours. They own hotels. They own they've got like a tramway that people can take up to the top of the largest mountain in this area. And so they do a lot of that. They do a lot of natural resource development, a lot of timber, a lot of fishing.
So these would be corporations with the shareholders that are based on sort of ethnic identity of some kind.
Right.
And so you could just be living in a tract house. And just happen to be one part, whatever part percentage it is, owner of this company.
Yeah, I can't remember. I mean, the distribution of shares really depends upon the corporation itself. I mean, they set up their own rules and so on. But as far as the proportions go, I'm not sure, you know, kind of how that shakes out.
This must lead to some pretty heavy sort of corporate management issue. I mean, if you've got a bunch of people who are basically inherited at a corporation, you know, I'm not saying they didn't deserve it, but I'm saying in terms of just sort of one day they woke up and realized that they were, one 100th owners of a copper mine or a tramway or a hotel or something like that. I mean, that must make some pretty complicated politics just in terms of...
It's not something I'm super familiar with. You kind of, you know, hear about these you know, the arguments that take place about, I think one of the, you know, the primary issue that the Native corporations have always faced is basically, you know, the I think the fundamental tension between a subsistence culture, which Alaska Natives throughout the state have tried in various ways to maintain, and the kind of demand, the profit demand of the corporation. I mean, when the Native Claims Settlement Act was established in 71, it had a sort of permanently transformative effect on Alaska Native culture and economics, because they're working within this corporate framework. And it wasn't a corporate framework that was necessarily imposed on them from the outside. I mean, this was a process that Alaska Natives participated in, but it still, I think creates a lot of tension.
Now, does the state make any attempt to oversee them, or
I can't recall the precise. Obviously, you know, the land that they control is, I mean, that's land, it's private land, and they're free to develop it and do what they want with it. Which given the environmental politics of the state, sometimes provokes a confrontation between Alaska Native corporations and white environmentalists who don't necessarily approve of some of the resource extraction policies that some of these companies have taken. So it makes for a very strange. Oh, sorry, my cat.
Right. Liberals want to be liberal on the score of being environmentalists, but then find themselves dumping on Native peoples.
Yeah, not really dumping, but just. I think there's a tremendous amount of opposing. I think it certainly does create some tensions. I mean, the Native Alaska Native population, like all Indigenous people in North America, I mean, they got a pretty raw deal over the long haul, and so of course they bear some pretty well placed sense that it's not appropriate for white Alaskans to tell them what to do with the land that they have.
Are the Natives identifiably Republican or Democrat, or both, or either?
I don't have the data.
Do they vote? I mean,
very, very powerful. The Alaska Native Brotherhood and Alaska Native Sisterhood, which are these old progressive era organizations going back to the World War I era. They played a very important role in Alaska's political history. My sense is that, like the rest of the state, the sort of Native political preferences are very regional, very sectional. I think in Southeast Alaska, it's fair to say that preponderance of Alaska Natives are probably Democratic, because that's kind of where the region itself trends. I think in other parts of the state, it's going to look different, and we've got quite a number of Republican representatives.
With Todd Palin. Is Todd Palin? I mean, is it? Is you always sort of hear that he's part? You pronounce the name right, and I won't even try.
Yeah. It's interesting.
Does he own a Native corporation? I mean, is he part of a Native corporation?
I don't know the details of that, and that's one of the things that's really interesting. I think it's like one quarter or one eighth. I can't recall the ratio. To what extent that really really matters? Who can say?
But it's never been discussed people don't bring it up and say this is why he holds this view or represents that.
No, I don't think so. He's kind of an enigma. He's one of the sort of interesting sort of facets of this whole process. He's a very important part of Palin's administration. He's a kind of her informal chief of staff, but we really don't know a whole lot about him, aside from what you hear through the rumor mill. But he's not been terribly, sort of vocal in this campaign. I think he gets up and says a couple words at rallies and then moves on. But he's an interesting character. We just don't know that much.
Very good. Well, so how do you think Palin will do in the debates? The debate, singular, I guess.
Well, this is the thing. This what's been going on with the press in the last couple of days. I think that there's, not to be overly snarky, but I think that there's a good reason that McCain and his campaign folks have been keeping Palin away from the press. I think it's in their interest to do it. They can continue to kind of hammer away this idea that the press is mean to her. Which I think energizes a lot of her supporters, the sense that the press shouldn't be allowed access to her because they supposedly fumbled the ball during the first couple of days after her nomination. The press has treated Palin really lightly up here until the Troopergate investigation, and she's never had to face tough questioning. If you listen to the primary debates and the gubernatorial debates in 2006. She wasn't particularly good, but neither was anybody else. And I think
she wasn't. I mean, because the impression you have is that she's a good talker and that she's sort of intense and smart and stuff.
As governor, when she gives press conferences, for example, when she meets with people, she's surrounded by staffers, folks who are kind of willing to be unkind about it will say, like, they don't think that she's particularly strong on a lot of issues, that she doesn't know a lot about. Some of the issues that she has to deal with. And so I think that it's possible that she could do really badly. The question, of course, is, well, how much is that going to matter? The data on debate bumps is like, it doesn't suggest that they really have much of an effect. And the vice presidential debates don't seem to matter, even close to what the presidential debates would count for.
Well, of course, the conventional wisdom of one time is out the window the next time. The rule was we weren't supposed to elect senators, and now we're guaranteed to elect a senator. And the rule was that whatever the political status quo is on Labor Day is what sticks through the election. And, of course, that changed too. So,
yeah.
I mean, these iron laws are just sort of suckers waiting to get broken.
Right.
You just never know when.
She opens her mouth and says things like, I'm reading this quote here this town hall thing they did the other day, and she said, oil and coal, of course, it's a fungible commodity, and they don't flag the molecules where it's going and where it's not. Google gobble, we accept her. I mean, it was a bad moment for.
This is her talking.
Yeah.
Fungible commodities.
Wow. Yeah. It was the Hillzoy at Washington Monthly was about the only person I could find who was able to decipher this. And basically, what Palin seemed to be suggesting was that the U.S. shouldn't export its oil. That the oil that we get from coastal drilling or from ANWR or wherever should go to American markets first. But you look at the data, as she did, and you see that the U.S. exports to Canada and Mexico, about a third of what we get from them. So, cutting off oil exports is just a really bad idea. But I think it kind of fits in with that thing of Palin, where it's, Alaska first, or even the McCain campaign slogan, country first. Well, that's a really bad policy if you're talking about the global market for oil. It's not even a coherent policy. So I mean, I think if she does stuff like that, it could be sort of a Dan Quayle, Lloyd Benson thing. But then again, that didn't seem to matter.
I think it did. I worked in that campaign. I think it did. It probably clipped a couple, two or three points off the Bush.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, I have heard people say that. So,
what do you think will come of the Trooper Gate thing? I mean, with Walt Monaghan and so on.
It's such a weird thing. Palin comes into office. She's got this very compelling persona as someone who's going to shake things up, someone who's not going to be as corrupt as her predecessor, open, transparent government, and so on and so forth. But once this story broke, she started shutting down. I think it's incorrect to say that Palin began stalling or stonewalling on the investigation when she got tapped for vice president. She started doing this before, like 2 weeks before. It was clear in early to mid-August that she wasn't going to be cooperating. I don't know what's going to come out of it. I mean, it looks pretty, pretty bad in some ways. Whatever the merits of the specific incident, whether or not she fired this commissioner because he wouldn't can her ex-brother-in-law, I don't think that matters nearly as much as what's been sort of obvious since then, which is that she's not kind of living up to this image that she kind of created for herself. And I think if people actually care about what happens in Alaska, and if people try to connect that with what we might be getting as a vice president, I don't think it looks particularly good, right? This whole kind of secrecy.
No, I know. I certainly didn't. I think a lot of it is, you know, these people who have sort of become somewhat named, like Walt Monaghan and Holland French and, you know, Stephen Branch Flower. These are all exotic people that, you know, nobody down here has ever met and so on. And you know, the question I have is whether any of these people are going to turn up and, you know, I mean, if they come down to Washington to go to the press club and hold a press, you know, that's one thing. And if they sit up there, sort of, you know, names in a paragraph, you know, in the Washington Post, that's another thing. And you know, I'm sort of curious as to which, you know, how fully this will develop in the next 6 weeks. So of course, if she doesn't win, you've got another 2 years to sort this out up there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's two investigations going on. One of them she's cooperating with, and one of them she isn't. The one she's not cooperating with is the one that the legislature set up by a unanimous legislative council vote, Republicans and Democrats alike. It's the one that she originally said that she would cooperate with. It's the one that the state, you know, the legislature has the power to do this. They can investigate anything they want. And that's the one that Steve Branchflower, who's a very well-respected, nonpartisan, it doesn't even live in Alaska anymore, former prosecutor. He's been tasked with sort of conducting the investigation. Now, you know, some of the legislators have said some things that are, you know, maybe a little bit ill-advised, but the fact of the matter is that the investigation is not being conducted by them. That's the one that she's, you know, they've issued subpoenas. The McCain's spokespeople have been the ones to say, you know, they're not testifying, they're not going to appear before the legislature. She's cooperating with the personnel board investigation, which is really, you know, a total clown show. I mean, this is a board that's composed of people that she can fire at any point. They're all, you know, Palin appointees. The deliberations, the investigation never has to be made public. If the complaint is found to be not worth a hearing, none of the details of the complaint or the investigation ever have to be disclosed. It can just, like, you know, trail off into a black hole. What's interesting is that Palin has complained about this process before. There was a complaint filed a couple years ago before she was governor. And, you know, she was out there advocating for, you know, this process needs to be transparent. It needs to be done quickly. We need to find out the details of this. But now, of course, when the shoe's on her foot, she's sort of all for the kind of slow, deliberative, secret process.
Well, whose ox is gored? It's nice to know that some things are completely universal in their application.
Yeah, but the legislative investigation is going to be done, and they're supposed to release their report on October 10th, which I guess is a couple days after the vice presidential debate. I can't recall when that's scheduled for, but you know, they were going to Palin's folks were going to, you know, kind of write this off as a partisan smear job, no matter what. It didn't matter what Hollis French or anyone else said. They would have objected to, you know, whether he, you know, chewed his food with his mouth open or what color sweater he wore. That was an approach that Palin was going to take, whether or not she was selected as Palin's VP. But obviously, the selection has kind of crystallized her opposition, and now she's got, you know, McCain campaign folks here basically like running the governor's office. It's a very strange development. The state's been, the executive branch has just kind of been taken over by McCain people.
Wow. I mean, Dave, this is very interesting. We've gone over an hour, and I don't want to tax anybody's patience or time, but certainly I've enjoyed this. I've learned a lot. You know, this is a window into, you know, Ambrose Bierce, the famous wit from the 19th century, said that, you know, war is the devil's way of teaching us geography. you learn about Tikrit and, you know,
right.
Kandahar and wherever else.
Yeah. Well, you should come up here. Come up to Juneau. I'll buy you a beer at the hangar. Overlooking. You got to come here on a day that's not raining, which is a rarity.
Which is one day a year, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Well, in any case, I mean, I think this is a lot of fun, and I hope that all of Alaskans, this is their chance to, you know, bring a unique, you know, I never saw the TV show Northern Exposure, which I in my life.
No, well, you watch Ice Road Truckers now, apparently. Yeah, no, in a couple weeks, hopefully we'll all just sort of slip back into our comfortable anonymity. And my 15
prosperous
minutes.
Prosperous anonymity.
Right. My 15 minutes of relevance will be over. So.
Anyway, Dave, thanks on behalf of Blogging Heads.
Hey, thanks
to us.
For having me.
And I hope our paths cross again, maybe down here somewhere.
All right, I'll keep you in mind.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Jim.
Bye-bye. Bye.